cliffcentral.com.
I'm going to speak to Dr. D about Oscar Pistorius and the sentencing that happened yesterday. Dr. D obviously has been paying very close attention to this trial, to the sentencing, to the opinions of people in the public, to Oscar's own mental health. And of course, Dr. D always adds tremendous value for us. Our attention this morning to none other than our own Dr. D. And what a pleasure it is to see you again, Dr. D.
Pleasure to be here with
you. Do you like your fanfare?
I do indeed.
So, Dr. D, listen, this Oscar Pistorius trial, do you agree with me that it's been sometimes a national pastime, sometimes a national distraction, and that actually none of this stuff should matter as much as it does?
I think that it should really matter in a way, because it is, somebody said, I can't remember who initially, but it's a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions. It really is. And I think that these kind of things do matter and should matter. The fact that you're calling it a pastime is almost like, have you seen the Oscar show? And I remember right in the very beginning when we were talking about, is it a good thing or not to televise all of this? I thought, kind of being in the media, that the public have a right to know. Mm-hmm. And that it probably would be a good thing. But when I've seen part of the effect of it, especially the effect of the huge social media, the kind of inciting nature of it, yes, it does give everybody an egalitarian voice and everybody a platform. But I think that there have been some quite difficult negative effects of it, and that the public on the whole, honestly, there were times where I thought, you know, like they're a pack of frenzied feeding dogs, stoning an infidel. And a lot of, and there's this inciting nature and groupthink that happens because of the social media. You know, you need to feel that you belong and that you're in and that you're part of the conversation. And at times it made it quite difficult for people to have an introspective and studied and personal view. Even, well, a lot of adults I'm talking about. I mean,
there's a lot of child going on online too, because yesterday there was hysteria from both sides. People saying, oh my God, it's an outrage that he got 6 years, he should be free. And other people saying it's an outrage that he got 6 years only and he should be in there for life.
I think there were very strong opinions on both sides. In my experience of it, one side was the majority. You know, it was yesterday, I think there were more comments. Maybe there weren't. Maybe it was the ones that I heard of, that it was too light. And it was a bit of a travesty. But what I'm finding is quite interesting with that is that those who say that actually still haven't even accepted the proper verdict, never mind the sentencing. The ones who are saying that are still, if you grind down with them, you know, of their opinion that there was an intention to shoot and kill Reeva Steenkamp, and that they haven't accepted that there was no evidence, not one shred of evidence, showing that there was an argument. And because they're still holding that assumption, everything else, all the consequences after that, make sense to them. So if you hold that kind of initial assumption, which might be wrong, you know, then everything else follows. I mean,
is that what we call cognitive dissonance?
Well, cognitive dissonance is kind of more when, you know, yeah, well, I suppose so. I mean, when the inside and the outside don't match, it's more called, if you want a more technical term, kind of selective evidence, where you make everything fit your initial assumption.
Right.
So I can look at you and I can say, you know, I've never really told you before, Gareth, but I know you don't really like me. Now, look how you peer at me through those eyes with your head right down, and now you're nodding your head in that kind of slow manner, and you've got that small sardonic smile, and you're putting your hand on your knee. You see, I'm right, all of this. I can take anything that I want to say and make it fit. And I think that what they've done is that people were so convinced, and one can talk about why they convinced themselves that this must have been an argument, that his version was so incredible that it couldn't have. My husband would have definitely woken me up. Surely, if you've got a partner and you hear a noise, you do this and this and this. Or take a lot of it was also because of the context of this case. We live in a society that is characterized by a high level of violence,
especially
and women abuse.
Women, yeah.
And so, you know, this is how can he get away with this? Not didn't matter that there wasn't really any evidence that he'd ever abused her.
And then there's this strange thing that happens, because if you can't project your anger at Oscar because maybe you feel that's not a loud enough forum anymore for you, and maybe you find the sentence is too lenient for your initial assumptions to be corroborated, then they take it out on the judge, and her competence is called into question. The fact that she's a black woman is called into question by some. The fact that she is too light on him, that she must have some kind of sympathy for him that we don't understand, that maybe she's been paid off by the Pistorians. Nonsense. All of it, absolute nonsense, right?
All of it is nonsense, and it's all of the above that you've said, really. You know, Gareth, I must say, I did something very strange with this case.
What's that?
And I was in the minority. I actually waited for evidence. Could you believe that I thought that it could be quite important? You know, there were three judges, one and two assessors, and this whole thing about race, you know, two women, two black, an Afrikaans guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, people would say from the beginning, so what do you think? And I would say, let's wait for the evidence. I did have an opinion. I said, and they said, you know, they looked at me as what? But why? Why would you ever want to do that? Everyone knows what happened. You know, surely. You know, so for a lot of people, the case, the trial actually was fairly irrelevant once their mind had been made up.
Yeah, which, by the way, makes the whole point of any kind of judiciary cosmetic.
It, well, yeah, certainly up to point, except for the fact that the sentencing is going to be based on the fact and not on public opinion.
Yeah.
In other words, you can have as much public opinion as you want. I thought the judge was very clear and very good. Look, it's the biggest, it's the hugest jury ever, this trial. But one has to be very careful about how much weight. Public interest has to be taken into account, but public opinion, you can't let really cloud your judgment as far as is possible.
And that's why we have judges. That's why when you do allow the public to vote at election time, it's just a popularity contest. When you allow them to vote on a Brexit, they go for a no. When you ask them to vote for Donald Trump, they'll probably do it. Mm. And when we come to important things like the State versus Makwanyane trial, which abolished the death penalty, it isn't put to referendum. Because people, general, ordinary people, you and me, don't always bother to read the Constitution, and we don't know about statutory or common law. Mm. And this is the purview of learned people.
I think that that's true, really.
Which is why we are happy to submit ourselves to the judiciary for an arbitration on the facts.
Well, I think that should be happy, you know, to and recognize what you're saying. You know, a lot of the outrage, as you say, a lot of people aren't, and they will find either projecting onto Oscar or on the judge, as you said. So it's interesting to really look at what were the real facts and what could be substantiated. And I thought that she did a really good job yesterday, because she spoke about the basis on which the sentencing needs to be constructed. And then she unpacked all of those things.
And nobody was listening to any of this, by the way.
I was, every word of it. But, you know, because I wanted to see what informed the sentence.
Mm.
And she went into all the aspects, really. I mean, as you say, for a lot of people, it didn't really make any difference. If it was the sentence they wanted, you know, then she would have been okay. At last, she's seen the light. And if it wasn't, then she hasn't. And so, you know, a lot of it has been like that, you know.
Now, Dr. D, the other thing we've got to talk about is these people who are baying for blood and think that 6 years in prison is a walk. You know, that's somehow a lenient sentence, when you and I have observed in close quarters people who have found themselves in prison and have even been in experiences where we found ourselves broadcasting from prison, in my case and in your case, having to deal with some people who've been sent there. It's not a pleasant place, even for 5 days, let alone 6 months, let alone 6 years. He's already spent a year in there. I'm not trying to be in any way favorable to the situation or to show leniency to Oscar Pistorius. I haven't yet said what my opinion on the sentence is. It's not my place to have one, in my opinion.
Oh, listen, you, every other person in South Africa has one. Gareth Cliff, but you allowed your opinion.
But Mabali said rightly this morning, my opinion is either that you think the judge did right or you think the judge did wrong. Your opinion isn't that, you know, that you would know better somehow. That can't be your opinion.
No, okay, that can't be your opinion, but I think that whether the judge did right or wrong depends on how much you understand about the facts of the case. If you really understand what the evidence was, what they could prove factually beyond reasonable doubt, which never came to the fore, for instance, this huge, huge assumption, and I can really understand where it comes from. We can talk about where it comes from, that they must have had an argument, or even they did have an argument, mm-hmm. how people really believed it. But the actual fact is that that could never be proved. There was never an argument. And therefore, the whole thing of blind rage or even deliberate intent on that continuum just couldn't be there, because it just what everything they tried to kind of really grind down and show evidence fell flat with that. So it's not, you know, people talk about whether you think the sentencing is correct, and certainly jail is no walk in the park. Mm-mm. But it's not meant to be.
No.
One of the things that she said, which was interesting, was she said, you know, the defense had asked for community service or house arrest, and that it was quite noble of Oscar to talk about community service. But she made the very strong point in delivery of the sentence yesterday that it's not about what Oscar wants, and it's not necessarily about what's comfortable. She's not going that route, because one of the things, you know, of a sentence has to also be retribution. It's got to be rehabilitation, but it also has to be retribution. And she said it's got to be something that's uncomfortable.
Right.
You know, and that isn't nice. And so there needs to be a jail term.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, let's not discount the last 3 years of experience for him. This experience has probably done more damage to him than 6 years in prison will do. Because it's been such a visceral, such a public, such an ugly, nasty... there can be no... Even if... Let's imagine that at that moment he did decide he wanted to kill Reva. The very next moment, he must have been filled with regret. And from that moment on, you've seen he's been a wailing, bawling mess. He's deteriorated psychologically. We can see it. And you can speak of this with your experience in psychology. He is a totally broken, damaged human being at this stage. Even if some part of him retains, I don't know, some kind of macho... The original Oscar, the kind of winner, the guy who put on those legs and ran.
Look, I think that they're hugely important and interesting things in what you're saying. I mean, many people have spoken about the two Oscars, especially his defense. And I think in growing up, there were very clearly two, possibly more than two, because his message that he picked up from the very closest person in his life, and I think internally her influence still remains the most profound, was his mother, who, you know, when he had his legs amputated, and from the time that he can remember, he was 11 months old, she gave him the message of saying, listen, you will be as good as, if not better than anyone else. This is we're not going to let this stop you in terms of everything that you can achieve. So he internalized that message and made it his own. Not everyone would be able to. So part of that's got to be his own personality as well. But the result of that was the hero, the resilience, the discipline, the focus, the winner, the no alternative. And that held him in great, great stead. I think that even being as broken as he is, there might be a tiny spark of that still where that can come to bear, that he will absolutely, with some help, make come to bear to face this huge, huge, huge challenge. Not only the external challenge, it's what he has to live with internally for the rest of his life. That he killed her and the blood is on his hands, and he has spoken about this. By the way, no one will hear that, because there's a huge need for polarity here. He has to be the villain, the family, and a lot of other people. And
explain that need for polarity to me, because this is a very South African, but it's a very human thing. In this story, this epic of Shakespearean proportions, how are we built to need a story with a clear villain, a clear heroine or hero, an obvious tragedy or drama or comedy. What is that all about?
You know, I think that we need to have someone, as you say, to project the blame or to be the scapegoat for all sorts of ills, personal stories that we might not have come to terms with of our own, in our own families, the story of what's happened in the country, the fact of we find it very difficult, I think even ordinarily, to see good and bad in people living side by side. We want to make meaning and kind of come to a conclusion. So, you know, to see that there are aspects of both, or the one in some ways people feel completely destroys the other. The fact that he was the hero just doesn't count for a lot of people anymore, you know. So, and in many situations like that. So if his voice resembles in any way the voice of the victim or victims, victims also being the family and what they're going through, and a lot of people, you know, many, many people who feel very deeply and care about Reva besides the whole drama of it. When he starts saying that she was at the prime of her life, that she had her whole life ahead of her, that she would have been a mother, that it was just, I mean, that voice often isn't heard. If it's someone else's voice, like her cousin's voice, Kim Martin, with sometimes an overlap of the words, you know, then I think that would be heard. There's a kind of need. And I think maybe, I don't even know if the law had anything to do with it, they might have. It wouldn't have been good for the case to see a huge kind of signs of any, of connection, and definitely not of forgiveness. So certainly maybe now some we might see some of that in the future, but they needed, even for the legal case, polarity, to keep it separate and binary like that.
And Dr. D, people are also interested in retribution. They say it's justice a lot of the time. And there may be people who do genuinely want justice of a kind. And that's maybe why they're so interested in this case, because they see a wrong done and they want to see the law applied equally to all people. And they think, well, 6 years for murder seems very soft.
You see, I think that that's why the judge made a point, and she said it more than once. First of all, there are, what did she say, compelling and something beginning with an S?
Substantive?
Maybe substantive, but anyway, you could reduce the minimum, which was 15 years, because of compelling circumstances. More than once she said it gives you the opportunity to look at each case in its own merit. So she felt that the mitigating circumstances in this case in some way outweighed the aggravating circumstances. So certainly the aggravating circumstances were, in terms of dolus eventualis, which we can talk about, because they didn't accept what I thought could have happened, which is something that's called emotional or amygdala hijack, which means if your child runs into the road, right, do you stop and think, if I run into the road, I might be run over by a car? What happens is that the primitive brain fight or flight kicks in, and instead of being able to respond, which means that there's a little gap between the stimulus and response where you can think, you can't think, you react. There's a great amount, huge amount of blood and oxygen, which floods that primitive emotional
reptilian
brain, and then it causes you for survival.
Instinctive
reaction. I thought, and when I was watching this, that this might have happened. I wasn't sure what precipitated it. It could have been blind rage, which could have been, he had a real trigger. If he was denigrated or demeaned or made to feel less than, that would set him off. It was a real trigger to him. The other trigger was also fear and vulnerability. If he was scared and vulnerable, so either version could have been the case. It could, that wasn't it wasn't improbable that there could have been a fight. There just wasn't evidence for it. So it could have been stimulated by blind rage, or it could have been blind fear. The fact is, because of watching that kind of thing and listening to his evidence, where people thought that he was a really bad witness and he was confused, I was seeing elements of this being overcome by emotion and then reacting like that. Because I've seen it often. I've seen dealt with people who've been had up for road rage. Mm. The other day I was at a dinner with the most conservative elderly accountant who was sitting around the table, and he was telling a story of how recently there'd been a break-in into his house and his wife and daughter had been attacked, and he picked up a chair and he started attacking the attackers. And he said it was the most stupid, irrational thing that he could have done. He could have been shot in a heartbeat. Had he thought about it, there are many people who've lost their lives because of it, and there are many people who've saved lives because of it. Mm. Sometimes the outcome is good. However, in terms of this case, that kind of automatic response was never really accepted. They didn't consider it to be enough evidence, and there wasn't enough to be made of it. Therefore, it was dolus eventualis, which meant they believed that he must have known that the possibility of killing someone, Reva or anyone else, in this case an intruder, could have been there if you shoot four bullets through an enclosed door. I think at that moment it could have been 4, 20, 50 bullets. He was in that kind of state, which is no excuse. I have to say that over and over again, because people think I'm being supportive of it. And I'm not. I just see it as a dynamic that happens, and you still have to face consequences of it.
Now, what about that documentary that they released just a couple of days ago where he was crying pretty much the whole way through, and it was very me, 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 and, you know, how Reva would have wanted him to not go to jail and all kinds of other very bizarre stuff. What did you make of that?
Say what you want to say, all other what?
Bullshit.
Yeah.
It's see, like
you were...
Yeah, bullshit.
You were...
I mean, I can't... Yeah. I can't... you know, I don't respond to that kind of emotional caricature. The sort of this trap of sympathy. What do you make of that?
Look, I think that it wasn't that different. It might have been different in extent. And one of my colleagues made the point that he has told the story and, in fact, lived with the story many times. There was one aspect, that aspect of the his emotion was so, it was very interesting because he spent most of his life, Gareth, not showing any vulnerability. And that fact, in people who can't show vulnerability, especially those who need to maintain an image, are more likely to have a condition called IED, which is intermittent explosive disorder. Intermittent explosive disorder means you can lose it. You can be kind of triggered quite quickly in the way that we've said. And it's more likely when you haven't been able to discharge some of the things that you've shoved under your emotional carpet such that it looks like the Alps, you know. And so it can be sort of triggered like that. And in people who need to be heroic, and he spent quite a lot of time, not really responding to your question, but a lot of his life maintaining and building the image. That's why there were Jolla friends, fast cars, beautiful women, deadly weapons. This is me, the big Oscar, the big. But when he took off his legs and inside, I'm sore sometimes. I can't really talk about it. I get jealous. I feel insecure. I'm not always that confident as I come across to be. And so I think that there definitely was this. And now it's kind of very ironic that that Oscar has been unleashed and burst out in an uncontained way, in a way that you and other people find either unreal or uncomfortable. He's certainly kind of going for it in a way, maybe even milking it in a way that he tried to protect it for so much of his life. I believed it more, maybe it's also because I've seen it, you know, more than once, but I believed it more when he was on the stand. Those kind of responses I really felt were real from the very beginning with Stip, who came in and saw him just afterwards. and he's described it. I mean, if you want to hold the assumption that that wasn't true, you will make it fit, as we said in the beginning. But this pleading for her life, and please God, please don't let her die, and I will sue. You know, the judge, Stip, people were convinced that that was real and that the remorse was genuine. And also she said something that I didn't expect her to really say yesterday in the sentencing about the number of times that he had approached the family, you know, wanting to meet with them with an apology. Once again, I think that would never have suited the case from the prosecution, and that was really all that was blocked. But she said, can you imagine how hard it must be to be able to face and talk to, in a sense, you know, the real victims of this, the living victims of this. And she kind of labeled that as a positive thing.
Well, what do you think the prognosis is for his psychology over the next 6 years? I mean, he's going to come out, he'll be 36 or 38 years old.
I think he'll serve half of the six,
yeah,
because that's the minimum of the law.
Mm-hmm.
He's already served one. I think that he's going to, you know, there's the possibility of parole after half, which I think there was something to do. The lawyers will tell you that there wasn't, it had to be more than five, okay, for that condition to happen. His prognosis, I think, that if you listen to very considered opinion of Professor Stoltz, other people speak about him being broken. I think he's been deeply, deeply, deeply affected. In a sense, that's more of a punishment than he's ever going to get. Not to say that that doesn't mean we go. And he will be deeply affected. And I think that there will be many people who will say, oh, that's the guy who, leave out the deliberately, but it's implied, murdered his girlfriend forever. I don't know if he's going to be ever really able to overcome that. But I still think that because of the huge challenges that he had to face from the time he was very little, and the strength of the strength that he had to build up, he's had a practice run. He's had a real practice run in coping with adversity. He's had to, with no legs. And I think that some of that, that little spark of that, in a determined way, with help, he will bring to bear to cope for the next 3 years. I'm not of the opinion that he's going to do himself in or anything. I think that
that's interesting.
Will, yeah.
That's a very interesting point of view. Dr. D, what about us as a nation? Are we just going to move on because we have such a short attention span and social media will suddenly drum up some other controversy or some other outrage or some other reason for us to be pissed off?
Well, I think even if we look at that, I think you're right. I mean, you know, it's quite an indictment on us, isn't it, Gareth?
I mean, listen.
I mean, if you think
I had
of
an
it
experience
like
of this in January where I was something of an object for it. In no way comparable to what Oscar's had to deal with.
Oh, you have no idea what an object you were.
Yeah, but not on the scale that he's had to deal with, and certainly not on the scale that politicians are consistently exposed to. And not only politicians, because maybe they deserve it, but, you know, Kelly Kumalo and Boiti Tulo and all kinds of people who will post a picture or say something innocuous and suddenly have the wrath and hatred of a group of nameless, faceless nobodies turn on them like a swarm, and as you said, a pack of hungry dogs after a kill. What is going to happen to us that will stop us from behaving like this? Because it's such primitive amygdala type behavior.
Yeah, it is.
Groupthink.
You know, it is. And yeah. I think that, you know, one of the things, I'm not very good at it. I need to improve my social media techniques. I mean, technically, you know, it's a big problem. It's the only place, Gareth, I promise you, the only place where I feel a generation gap. I'm not good at it. Sometimes I have to call my kids to help me. But, you know, when you're in this business that we're in, you've got to learn how to tweet and do things. So with difficulty yesterday, I did tweet, and what I did say is that I think that as the public, we need to become, maybe this trial will help us realize that we've got to become more introspective, and could we please base our opinion more on fact and not so much on assumption and myth. And I had something very interesting happen to me. You know, I'm Jewish, and I got a letter from a lawyer who happens not to be Jewish. But the point was, he said to me, as a Jewish person talking to me, he said, I'm sure you cannot believe that all my colleagues, my Jewish colleagues, lawyers, and other Jewish people have jumped on the same bandwagon as the rest of the public have. And I said, so what are you talking about? He said, that's the stuff that has fueled anti-Semitism. Myth, assumption, perception
yes.
has been taken out against people in xenophobic ways, not only Jews or whatever, mm-hmm. not based on anything.
But Dr. D,
and
this,
people still jump on this thing.
This is why anti-Semitism is the most wretched, evil, and nasty of all the kinds of bigotry, because it is the source code for all the others. It was there before any of the more modern prejudices. And to me, what you're referring to here is when groupthink happens, and it happens in a hateful way.
Mm.
And social media is just really writ large.
Fueled it.
Mm. It's writ large the kind of origins of these sorts of deep prejudices. If we don't eradicate it at its source code, anti-Semitism, it's just going to grow everywhere else.
You know, look, I'm not really here to talk about that. I think there are people who have much more expertise about that. I just found that an interesting thing.
It's an interesting observation.
A really interesting observation to say, you know, many people have been the victims of assumption and perception
mm-hmm.
that becomes so real that it is actually acted upon as if it's pure fact. And if you say what's going to happen as a result of this trial, unfortunately, I think probably not much. Probably not much. Maybe what should happen is, guys, can we stop? Can we see a big red stop sign before we jump to conclusions? Just see it in your head. Stop. Look inwards. Think, what is this based on? Maybe what am I dealing with that it suits me to have this opinion, because maybe it's internally, not externally based. What are we living with in the country? Let me consider this carefully, or have some conversations, interesting, challenging, courageous conversations with people before we just absolutely jump to conclusion. You know, I hope that maybe we do that a little bit. Whether we do, I don't know.
All right. Thank you, Dr. D. It's always good to talk to you. I feel like we've all had a national therapy session after you've been here. Is there anything you want to throw in, Ben or Mubs? Because I think we've pretty much covered the course here. Anything else? Anything from you two?
No, not really. But that whole thing about perception and assumption, it's so true. Because there's elements of that in every story, mm-hmm. all of our lives. And it is the danger. It's this whole angry mob scenario.
Mm.
But also this internal external thing is massively important, because
yeah.
I don't think we've dealt with a lot of our wounds as a country and as individuals in a country.
I think that's true, you know.
And sometimes
I mean,
it suits us to take on the feelings of groupthink because it makes us feel part of something, so it gives us some solace. But it's false.
It is, but you know, I can also understand, as you say, giving us some solace, because really, Gareth, as human beings, we're wired for connection. We are wired for connection in terms of relationships, individual relationships, and in terms of a need to belong. I mean, one can take a leap from this and look at why, you know, how people are lured into ISIS.
Mm.
And feeling that they're going to be part of a bigger group that has meaning or purpose or whatever it is. So I think that you know, where that comes into it as well, just mm-hmm. I'm part of this. I had to quite a lot, and you've had to, because I know many times in this last incident, just have to think to yourself, how do you deal with this? And that saying that what other people think of me is none of my business. You know, it's easy to hold the populist view. You can just reflect what people think and everybody will like you. But to be authentic and say, why am I saying this? What necessarily has informed it? What past experiences have I had? People don't have time nor the inclination to do that much. And to be able to hold your own authentic, hopefully informed opinion isn't always easy, as you know. Right. But often the results are good. So.
Well, thank you, Dr.
Okay.
D. Very,
well,
very lovely to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks
lovely
for popping
to see
by.
You.
I know you've had a busy couple of days with all of this, so I appreciate you making some time for us. Thank you so much.
Always top of the list.
Dr. D, Dari Wheel, and of course you will have seen her on television, you have heard on radio over the last couple of days, and she's the one who we wanted to talk to when it comes to understanding our place in all of this, and also what's going on in the head of a judge or a murderer And who knows sometimes. CliffCentral.com.